and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Annie.
And I'm Dave. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, a TV show or book we're a fan of before we're married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month, in an unusual turn of events, we have two special guests. Our friends Terry and Liz have come along to help us out this afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Hello!
Hello!
Terry and Liz have selected our topic for this episode's discussion, which is the story of the Weeping Camel. So, I'm fascinated to know how you came across this and why you picked it.
So, about 20 years ago, there was a film festival that we went to, and it was just one of the films on, and I thought, I've never seen a Mongolian film before. We paid our money and went to it, and I was just, well, I think we were both just enraptured by it at the time. And it's one of those things where when someone says, what's your favourite film? You don't want to say something like too obvious, because, you know, you just sound a bit, you know, boring and mainstream.
We'd just moved to a new city, and we were trying to make friends. We were bright, young, early 20-somethings. And I think we both wanted to come across as very sophisticated, urbane, debonair, and how better to do that than by recommending esoteric international cinema to people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair.
And so when you said, you know, what's something that you last saw 20 years ago, you know, what's your... And we just thought...
It was the first thing that came to mind. Turns out now I'm a slightly less bright young 40-something. I have not grown out of the instinct that international cinema is the way to make people think you're clever.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So,
I mean, for your brother.
See, I made Dave watch the Care Bear movie, you know. So you're raising the stakes.
Excellent.
Quite a lot.
I mean, for your brother, who is almost certainly listening and his great love of international cinema.
Absolutely.
But he is very clever. So.
He is very clever, yes.
So it works.
Indeed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what were your thoughts overall?
I didn't really know what to expect, and I'm still not entirely certain what it was that I watched. I have questions.
You always have questions.
But we will come into that later. I enjoyed it. It's a quiet film,
yeah.
I would say, so, both literally and figuratively.
So the word that I would use is understated. It's really, really understated, which is very much not the kind of thing we normally do. So it's very different to our normal fare, which is great because it's good to do something that's unusual.
I'm very much looking forward to the discussion. I will say that. But yeah, it took me by surprise in a good way.
Oh, fantastic. It's nice to recommend something that people don't immediately go, I hated every minute of it.
Well, that often produces a more interesting discussion.
You can pretend that you hated the camel. So how about a brief synopsis for those people who haven't seen it?
Probably quite a lot of people.
Quite a lot.
It's not a very well-known film.
I've never heard of it.
Tell us about...
Do you have a synopsis prepared? Or shall I wing it?
You can wing it, or I can.
So it's set, as you said, in Mongolia, and it centres around a family group who kind of live in the desert and have a lot of camels. And essentially what happens is one of the camels is born, and it's a rare white camel, but the mother rejects it, and the rest of the film is the family trying to get the mother and calf to bond, and eventually recruiting a musician from the nearby educational centre to come and do a fascinating ritual in which he plays music and they sing to the camel, and then everything works out in the end in a surprising way. And that was about it, really. Does that encapsulate?
I think that's, yeah, it's a story about what it means to, you know, feel a bit rejected and people coming together and how.
But it is
can...
a documentary, right? They are all kind of.
Wow!
So that is the most important thing to discuss. Well, one of the most important things to discuss. I don't know if we want to leap into that now, but that is a big topic.
So the director herself is Mongolian,
okay.
And it is filmed as though it is a documentary.
Yeah.
And obviously there is a camel being born. That's not special effects. How much of it is... It's quite obviously not a documentary, because cameras are sometimes set up where people suddenly come in, or, you know, they're behind when the children have to go off to buy batteries, and the camera is already set up in the shop when those kids come in. So it isn't.
It's kind of curated.
Yes, and
So what it kind of, I think it says in the Wikipedia page, is it's filmed as though it were a documentary by the people that would have been in the documentary. The thing that
right.
the thing that makes it non-documentary for me is that nobody ever looks at the camera.
Yeah, and which nobody's like interviewed as such. It's exactly, kind of filmed as if you were doing a real, going on if you, in real life.
Yeah, if you're doing a real world documentary, you would basically stand behind the camera and they would look at you and look into the camera and that.
Well, I think there's a couple of places where that does happen. So right at the start, the patriarch looks into the camera and says, "I'm going to tell you the story of how the camel
already wrong.
Lost his horns," and then there are a few bits when they're following the kids around the cultural centre. Some of the other kids are sort of lean and peer into the camera as well. But it is most of the time it is the camera is a fly on the wall and no one is sort of turning to it and making a face or making a comment.
So yeah, it's it was described as a at the time it was described as a narrative documentary. It was a docudrama before docudramas were really that big. It was still kind of a fairly new way of storytelling. 20 years later, it put me in mind of Nomadland. I think there's always that sort of ethical question of if you've got people who are playing themselves, how complicit are they in spinning a narrative? Or is it really kind of fly on the wall, this is just what life is like?
But that was what really confused me, and I know we're kind of getting wildly out of the normal scheme of things, but that's fine, this is where we are right now. Because they were obviously filming sections before the camel was born, and they actually filmed the camel being born, and you kind of have to assume that it was the real camel and the same camel mother and child, and they didn't know that the mother was then going to reject the camel, which then became the whole focus of the story. So why were they filming in the first place? That was what was confusing me.
Yeah, when I rewatched it, one of the things that I was worried about was I would look at it and go, "Oh, this is quite obvious how they've done it." But it's not like you can make a camel act.
No, exactly.
So that camel is desperately crying for its mother.
Yeah, and the mother is desperately trying to stop it from
feeding. So, I mean, I presume they knew that they were filming around camel breeding, you know, calving season or whatever.
Yeah, they couldn't have known that was the story they were going to tell when they started.
Probably not, but so the filmmaker, Bayan Basaran Devar, is...
Oh, well done. I was looking forward to not having to do that, so thank you.
So her body of work is very much around the nomadic culture and lifestyle.
Mm.
So my sort of supposition is that a huge amount of footage was shot and it was then edited into a coherent story when this thing happened, but they
kind of lucked out that they got this really emotive arc.
Perhaps they lucked out, but also perhaps this is actually quite a regular occurrence.
Yeah,
I mean,
fair.
There is an entire ritual for handling it
also
when
true.
This happens.
Yes.
So perhaps there was a bit of a kind of. I mean, I don't know over how many years it was filmed, but perhaps
also a good point.
There's a kind of, well, you know, chances are there's going to be a traumatic birth and something's going to happen that we can turn a film into.
I can answer that question. In fact, can we rewind to what we would normally do, which is the
facts
section of things?
I, as usual, have no facts.
I, as usual, have written chunks out of Wikipedia.
I've got some facts as well, which I thought were quite fun. But
please,
I think you do your facts first, Dave.
My copying out of Wikipedia standardness. So it's filmed in 2003. It was directed by...
Oh, I've lost the name. Bayan Basaran Devar.
Thank you very much.
Not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Who is best known for films such as The Cave of the Yellow Dog in 2006, in which she won the 2006 German Film Award for Best Children's Film. And there's a quote from Roger Ebert, who obviously is a famous movie reviewer and knew more things about what was going on. This isn't actually on the Wikipedia page. This is in the talk section with somebody trying to get this included and failing.
wow.
But it says the filmmakers are Basaran Devar and Luigi Filoni. She directed, he did the photography, and they co-wrote it together. They met at the Munich Film School, where she told him that her grandparents had been herders. Their film was shot in location in under a month. And has authenticity in its very bones. So they only did a month's worth of filming.
Yeah, because the kids were quite, some of the kids were quite young and they didn't obviously change age.
Yes, they don't age on screen. The fact that I found, which just delighted me, this won the White Camel Award at the Sahara International Film Festival. Before looking it up, I thought perhaps this was an award given to films about camels. And I thought, well, this is wonderful, it's a shoo-in. But it turns out this is like the Palme d'Or at Cannes. So
that's amazing. Wow. This is actually about White Camel.
Yes.
So a few little bit more facts. So it was nominated for an Oscar in the category of Best Documentary in the 2005 Academy Awards. Didn't win. It did win an International Film Critics Award at the San Francisco International Film Festival. As you say, the White Camel Award in 2006. In Rotten Tomatoes, it currently has 94%, and in Metacritic, it currently has 81%. So it's very popular both with viewing public and critics.
Interesting.
It's pretty high.
Yeah, but it's a pity it's not more well known. I mean, foreign language films don't tend to do very well over here unless there's like a big push behind them. And it was you were talking about the Academy Awards. It was up against Super Size Me, which obviously was huge over here.
And I
mean, even today, the film is only out on DVD. It's not available on streaming. There's no 4K Blu-ray remaster or anything like that, which is, I think, a little sad because it is, as you said, it's a calm film. I found it quite moving.
And I'm assuming that the family life that they portray is their authentic family life at least an approximation of what you would expect those people to be doing of an evening. And I found that really interesting. The ways in which they were wildly different to me and also the ways in which they were incredibly similar to me and my experience, I found a really great combination that really drew me in.
So this is, given that we've not seen it for 20 years, we were thinking, you know, is it going to hold up for us? And we were both moved to tears almost by rewatching it, partly because this film has very sort of happy memories for us. But it's, what was it that you said? It's just an incredibly simple story. Very, very well told.
Yeah.
And the thing, when you're talking about, is it a documentary or not? Normally, if it were a documentary, you'd have David Attenborough saying, and here we see the camel pining for its mother. And you don't need that here because it shows you what's going on. You don't need to know. No one, for quite some time, no one says the mother has rejected the calf. You just see it going on. And there are very few points where they, even the language of the humans as opposed to the language of the camels, but that there are subtitles, but not everything is translated because you don't need to know, you know, when the mother is picking up her crying child and singing a lullaby, you don't need that translated. You know what she's singing and it's, you know, go to sleep, baby, you know, it's the same the world over. And so, I really got that as well, that there are some things which are, why are they doing that? What's going on? This is a culture very different to our own. And the others are, this kid, all he wants to do is sit and watch TV.
Yeah.
And, you know,
my favourite bit for that was one of the first interactions with the little girl. She's, what, about 18 months old? Or like two or something. And she's the mother brings her in and the grandmother's there. And she says, I'm leaving her with you because I need to go and do something. And plonks her down. She immediately bursts into tears. And the grandmother rushes over and goes, oh, hang on, I'll give you a sweetie. And I'm like, oh, yes, universal.
Yeah.
The universality is something that was really resonating for us. And I think the juxtaposition of the camel, the maternal camel rejecting her colt, and that there's a particular shot where she just sort of kicks it out of the way with her knee.
Some of it was quite hard to
really
watch.
Just kind of gets you in the heartstrings. And then it's immediately then cut with pictures of with images of the human family and the mother kind of caring for her little daughter.
Yeah.
And it's without as you said, understated. It's making an incredibly powerful point, but it's utterly unlaboured. It's just a lovely little juxtaposition between those two.
So in a fairly standard podcast UI, I'm going to kind of just repeat what somebody else said and then pretend that I did it. what Terry was saying about the voiceover stuff, the Attenborough bit, is really interesting because there are two, it felt like, I don't know if it's just like very non-Western choices, one of which is not having a voiceover and the other one of which is not having background music. Because when you're watching most Western films, there's some kind of, it might be loud, might be quiet, but some kind of ongoing noise all the time.
Yeah.
And the idea that you're watching something where it's basically all you can hear is either the wind or nothing at all. Actual periods of silence when you're watching something is really unusual. It's really, really impactful. So there's, I don't know whether that's just normal for Mongolian cinema or if the director has made a specific choice to do it in that way. But yeah, and not having the camera be a character. So not, again, with the voiceover, not coming in and saying, this is the thing that is happening. I thought it was really interesting because I'm so used to understanding what I'm watching. And if there's a time when there's something going on, which, because it's not been explained to me by either the characters doing something that's telling you through the dialogue what they're doing, or there's a voiceover doing stuff, if there's stuff going on and you're like, I'm not really sure what's happening, that feels incredibly unusual because we're so used to having
everything over-explained,
the story just like drip-fed to you all the time.
Yeah,
it treats you like an adult.
And the significance of everything explained and stuff, and it's not, and you don't need it, as you say.
Yeah.
It's, there's no spoon feeding because it's just so obvious what's going on. And going back to this theme of universality, as we were watching, you said something along the lines of the cult is so upset because it doesn't know what it's done wrong, which is a very anthropomorphic way of thinking about it, and I think from a sort of naturalism perspective is perhaps not really accurate, but in terms of filmmaking, very impactful.
Yeah, and the emotion of it. Yeah.
I think with anything like this, when you're watching a foreign movie or one which is set so far away from you, both in terms of geography and life experience, it can be a bit... So sometimes it feels like it's a bit of exoticism that you're sort of intruding, or, you know, these rituals have been played up and, you know, you feel like you might be watching people in a zoo or something like that. But here it isn't. And I think part of it is because they do seem to be mostly going about their everyday life, and parts of it you completely recognise what they're doing, and, you know, if they're sat in the evening playing cards, and the bits where it is so different, you know, if you've lived a little, you understand, oh, right, this woman is performing a ritual outside. You don't really need to know what it is just to go, all right, I can map this on. And I think that's also reflected in, I assume none of us around the table are secretly camels. So,
not as far as I'm aware.
So we don't know what it's like to be a camel, or you know, what camel culture is like. But you can see
Thomas
straight...
Thomas Nagel's difficult second book, What It's Like to Be a Camel.
But, you know, we are watching animals... You know, and the mother has rejected the child, and the child is upset with this, and the mother is distressed. And it really doesn't matter if they're camels or humans a million miles away or a film set down the street. It's such a universal theme that, again, you don't need the character turning to camera and explaining what's going on.
Yeah.
So there's two things to pick up on there. Let's do the second one first. You talked about characters. I thought it was really interesting that right at the very end, all of the people who participated basically came up to camera and then got a name. What was really interesting about that is that one of the things that Annie often says when watching TV shows is, it's like, I've got half through the episode and they haven't told me what anybody's name is, because you like to absorb people's names for things as they go along. And I thought it was super interesting that you can pick up a small number of names in context, because they'll say, you know, you go to the shop and buy me some batteries, and you get that person's name.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of people, and the camels, don't get named until they're called out right at the very end, just before the credits.
Because people don't tend to use each other's names. Exactly. When just talking. Yeah. I mean, the two that you get are the two boys, because I think they're at the age when they would, the parents and the family would be using their names, because they're like, trying to get their attention and stuff. And I loved the fact that, I mean, obviously wasn't his actual name, but that they called the older boy Dude. That was so cute.
The other thing I was going to say is, and again, it's a very, I don't know if it's a very Western way of approaching stuff, but my brain kept going, where's the plot?
Really?
I get that we're like, you know, having a kind of day in the life, in inverted commas, kind of snapshot of this culture. But when I read the kind of description of the thing before I went in, it's like, you know, this very rare white camel is born and then is rejected, and that makes up really a very small amount of the runtime.
Yeah.
Mm.
And most of it is just what's going on in the lives of these people.
Yeah.
And my brain kept going, where's the next plot point that I can, you know,
where's the
narrative
that
I can anchor myself to get through? But that's not the point. That's not what it's for. So,
And one of my other favourite moments was there was a sandstorm at one point, and you saw them preparing and putting the extra cover over the hole in the roof of the tent and stuff, and getting kind of hunkered down and stuff. And then the following day, when the mother in the family came out, and she was sort of pulling the tarpaulin off and then brushing the sand off the roof of the tent. And I initially suddenly thought, what would be the point? Because, you know, you're surrounded by sand, you're going to have sand on the roof of your tent. But it was obviously important to her to kind of set things to rights after the storm and tidy up and make things look nice.
The thing I really love about that scene is, yeah, she comes out and she, you know, there's this great big tent and there's ropes and she starts sweeping, and then she picks up a brush and it's got a green plastic handle.
Yeah.
And for most of the film, you know, it feels like it could be set in any time in the last few thousand years, you know, that, oh, right, there's tools and they've got eyeglasses, but every so often they pick up something and go, oh, these are people who live in the modern world.
Yeah.
They live one step removed from it, but they, you know, they've got a radio which needs batteries, and they've got plastic tools, and they've got other stuff. And
Duda's hat is Nike, and someone's got an Adidas bomber jacket at one point.
Yeah. And the little boy is obsessed with them getting a TV.
So this is a big major point, that it's not a this is how people used to live, or this is how people who are cut off from the rest of the world live. This is how these people live now, which is a complicated and messy combination of traditional ways of living and quote unquote modern ways of living, all kind of mashed together in a very realistic way. The thing that stood out for me is that there's a scene where a group of people go and meet up with a couple of, when I say llamas, I don't mean llamas like camels, I mean llamas as in
priests,
thank you, to go and do, I can't remember why they were there.
It's a religious ceremony of some sort.
Kind of offering the food to the spirit.
They try one sort of prayer ritual first, which doesn't have the desired effect. So then they decide they need to do this more this music centered ritual, for which they need the violinist.
So and that was the, sorry, I'm interrupting you for a change.
Sorry.
That one where they were bringing the food as offerings, and they had the religious figures there in the robes, and they were sort of like doing some kind of prayer ritual. One of them made a bit of a speech about environmental impact, and said that people in other parts of the world are kind of disrespecting the land and driving the spirits away, and that's what means that they're getting worse weather and being more susceptible to diseases. And I thought, oh, they're having a little bit of a soapbox moment, but it's a very good point that, you know, we don't think about how the things we do might impact people in very, very different parts of the world, because obviously the climate change is affecting them, and they are perhaps getting, you know, worse immune systems and stuff due to chemicals or whatever and that we're introducing.
It's a very good point, and I think it's, I feel good is perhaps the wrong word, but I like the fact that it's them making that point.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
This isn't a kind of Western polemic being imposed on another community. These are people who live, as you say, in a very, Outer Mongolia is remote. It's kind of remote from everywhere. It's one of those places where that the line between what we might somewhat patronisingly call civilization and the wildness of the rest of the planet, that barrier is just a bit thinner there.
Yeah.
And if you're living in those sorts of communities in those kind of areas, you're going to be feeling the effects of things like climate disruption much more acutely than people living in cities.
So I'm...
What was your point that I interrupted? I'm sorry.
So I feel that I'm going to be possibly bad cop for a second, that everybody will hit me with stuff.
Go for
but
it.
But I'm going to be slightly cynical about stuff. So when they went to the religious gathering with the two llamas, where they're doing that first ritual, in the background of that shot, there are four or five relatively modern jeeps sitting in the background that people have obviously driven up with. And then very shortly afterwards, they need to go and get this violinist, and they send the two young boys off on camels to go and
do that. You don't know
and
how...
I wonder if behind the camera there's a jeep that they could have gone and driven to the place in like 15
minutes.
Yeah,
but the boys wouldn't have been able to drive there.
Yes, I know, but partly it might be, you know, sending the boys off on an experience to do a thing, but also I think there's a possibility of choosing how you do stuff to emphasise certain parts of the way that you live at the moment.
Well, probably. Possibly.
I think, this is the central tension at the heart of the film, is they live a remote life, but they've got a radio with batteries, and they want to, you know, have their keep their culture, but the kid is really into getting a TV because TVs are awesome.
And they're not that far away from quite a bustling town that's got this
education
centre.
I don't know whether there was a Jeep there that they could have taken, but quite obviously there is an emphasis on we want to keep this tradition alive, because perhaps the modern rational thing to do would have been to send for a vet or something like that if your camel is having difficulties, but instead they go down the traditional route and they try to keep those traditions alive. And but at the same time, you can see their kids really sort of straining at the idea of.
Yeah.
But what's super interesting about that is that they haven't made that the plot.
That's not the plot. Yeah, it's just.
Although they do have a TV at the end.
There's a very active choice to not make that the story. Because what you could have done is you could have said, look, if you go to the town that's down the road, what I thought was really interesting when they popped into the shop to buy the batteries is how many brands I recognised on the shelves. That there's a whole load of stuff that you can buy here that you can also buy there.
And global logistics, yeah.
Yeah. But you could have very easily written a thing about how all the young people growing up in these places say, why would I want to, you know, herd camels and live in a yurt and it's really difficult here when I could go and live in the city and get a job and it's so much better or different? And that then they've chosen not to make that the story, and I thought that was really interesting.
I agree. I think there's the parallel film that wasn't made from a kind of very Western anthropological kind of standpoint of we are making it's goodness me, these primitive uncultured people are starting to just kind of technology is starting to encroach on their reality and their territory, and it's happening because there's a kind of inevitability about the globalism aspect. But also, as you say, it's not the story, it's kind of incidental.
And having said that, what you were saying about the tension between the modern things and the traditional things, they go to the bustling town and to the education centre where there is a guy who is teaching. The two things that I found really interesting about this is that the town is quite modern and you've got all the brands and stuff and they're buying the batteries, and they go to the centre where the music lessons are happening, and he's teaching the kids a lesson on very traditional musical instruments, and he's also a relatively young guy and he's obviously living in the town, and yet without batting an eye he goes into the remote desert and does this ritual for fixing the problem with the camel. And he was obviously perfectly comfortable with that and knew exactly what to do, and I found that really interesting.
What I think's really interesting about this is that they're not saying the opposite of what I said, which is the traditional ways are best and the modern way encroaching into stuff is bad, and they're just showing what is. They're just showing how it currently is in a what feels like a tremendously non-judgmental way in any direction, which is quite hard to do.
Absolutely. So prior to us rewatching it earlier this week, I kind of wrote some notes about what I remember from it from 20 years ago. And what I wrote was, I remember it just being very matter-of-fact, very even-handed. It isn't judgmental. It's also not... it's not critical. It's not. We're not looking at this through a critical lens of here is what's wrong with this way of life. But it's not really evangelising either.
Yeah, there isn't really any commentary at all. It's just this is what happened.
This is how things are.
Yeah.
And these are the events that occurred, and this is how it was handled. It's a very clean kind of storytelling.
That's a good word.
Yeah. What else has anybody got that you want to...
What else have I written down in my notes? Oh, yeah, so I found this. So, back in 2005, Russell T. Davis was pitching for the new Doctor Who to come out.
I'm going to love to see where this goes.
And in his pitch document, he said, if the Zogs on planet Zog are having trouble with the Zog monster, who gives a toss?
Mm.
And his whole pitch for Doctor Who was, it's mostly going to be set on Earth, mostly in the modern day. You know, there's not going to be many alien adventures, because why should you care that, you know, this alien on an alien planet is having alien difficulties?
Okay.
And I think he is right for small-scale TV, but for a movie like this, I think it shows that is completely wrong. Because I'm not saying that people in Mongolia are aliens, but their culture is very different from us. And no one here has a problem with their camel, you know. You know, unless you live in quite a rural lifestyle, your farm animals rejecting each other, it's not a thing that bothers any of us.
Yeah.
But this story shows that you can...
Well, to be fair, we're all city slickers, so we don't really know that.
That's absolutely true. But...
I'm sure a lot of farmers would be very distressed by this situation.
I'm sorry, farmers. but it does show that if you have a story which is this painful and beautiful, it really doesn't matter where it's set, or even that... I mean, this film, you could make this exact same film, but it's a human mother who's rejected her child.
Mm.
And would it be any more moving or not if it was a human rather than a camel? I'm not... I think in the hands of this filmmaker...
Sounds a bit Ken Loach.
Yeah. But I think in the hands of this filmmaker, it doesn't really matter if the mother-child aspect of this are camels rather than people.
One thing that I've just thought of, though, we were talking about it being not critical or not evangelising or having any kind of commentary, but in the course of this, whether they've kind of staged this or not, or whether this was actually how it happened, they present the story as the guy comes and they do the ritual and it works.
Mm.
How do we feel about that?
I'm no scientist, but from a scientific perspective, I noticed a few aspects that I didn't notice the last time.
Okay.
Specifically, the way that they put the they sort of tie the stringed instrument. They refer to it as a violin. They tie it to the torso of the camel,
mm-hmm.
and the wind sort of vibrates the strings. And clearly the vibrations are kind of going through her body. And I'm wondering if, it's just in sort of purely scientific terms, is it something to do with finding vibrations at the right frequency that soothes whatever it is that kind of counterbalances what... I'm not a scientist, I am a rationalist. The rationalist in me needs there to be a rational explanation for it. There's got to be something physiological is happening.
But it could also be because they've been trying lots of different things.
Absolutely.
And they've been putting the cult with the mother and whatever, and perhaps gradually she's kind of come round to it. But the way they present it in the film is that nothing has worked. The guy comes and they do the ritual and then suddenly it's all fine.
So
but
I think
what my point was not, does the ritual work, but is there some kind of commentary in the fact that they show the ritual as working?
That's a fair point, and I think given that I don't own any camels, I feel
you don't own any camels yet.
Given that I do not yet own camels, I don't believe in magical thinking, but who am I to say?
Yeah.
I don't live in that kind of environment.
So,
and my daily life is not that close to the wilds of nature. So who am I to say that it doesn't work?
So I think there's three different things going on. One of which is, does this ritual actually work? Or, as you say, has the camel been introduced to the calf slowly over time? We can never know. We can each have our own opinion of what we think that
mm-hmm.
might be. So that's one thing. There's... are they trying to demonstrate some kind of, terrible air quotes here, cultural superiority of their method over other ways of doing stuff? Look at our ritual. This is the way that we've solved the problem, which I don't necessarily think they are. I think they're just showing what people did.
Yeah.
And then the third part is, why have they shown that particular thing at that point in the film? And I think that it's because even though most of it is just fly on the wall slice of life, I think, and obviously I'm guessing here, but I think in the back of the head of the director, they're like, really have to have some kind of narrative plot ending before the film finishes. There isn't a lot of plot, but
there needs to be some kind of resolution,
and so I think they put that in there
storytelling
so they can have a narrative endpoint.
And I think that's entirely reasonable. The story is called The Story of the Weeping Camel, and at minute 82 of the 88 minute film, you get the money shot of the camel's eyes starting to water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I disagree with all of you. The ritual worked because it's magic.
Okay.
It is. Perfect. I mean, this is how do you get a mother to fall back in love with its child? You need magic, yeah. and that's what it is. And I mean, yes.
I mean, endocrinology, perhaps.
No, you need magic, and I think all films rely on the fact that something magical has to happen in them, because otherwise they're just a bit dull and flat, pedestrian. Yeah. And so this is. It doesn't really matter if it's... I hate saying this about something which purports to be a documentary. It doesn't matter if it's true.
Mm.
It feels true. Because what we've seen all the way through is this is a very realistic, or what we think is realistic, look at life.
Mm.
And then at the end, there's some magic. And I just think it just lifts everything up. And there are plenty of films where people have gone, well, of course, I think in the last 10 minutes, he's actually dead and the whole thing's a dream. Or, you know, in the last 15 minutes, obviously that doesn't happen. It's just what we want to happen. And I think it's the same for this. It's if the story of the weeping camel ended with the mother camel kicking the baby camel to death, you know, it's not a great film. So you need something at the end to restore your faith in... I was going to say humanity, camel manity, camelty, yeah,
cameltude. I like your theory. I'm going with that.
At a danger of you know drifting into modernity, we could say it's true for them. It doesn't necessarily have to be true for everybody.
Yeah, fair. The baby camel ends up being able to get milk from his mother, so what more do we need?
Sometimes good things happen, and it's nice and important to tell those stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes,
that's
yes.
So true.
So actually, what I'm now thinking of is the film The Impossible, which is all sorts of problematic in all sorts of different ways, about the, but it's about a European family who was separated by the Boxing Day tsunami in Thailand. And sort of against all the odds found each other again.
Mm.
And it's you could, I mean, obviously we're not talking about the film, you can dissect it how you like, but ultimately it was a good news story. In all of this horrific devastation, something good happened and somebody decided to tell that story.
Yeah.
And whether or not it was done particularly well or may have kind of had its own issues, I think there is something worthy of celebrating the good news stories when they happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Any other points to make?
I think the only thing I was going to mention was just a bit about how it was shot.
In what way?
In the, again, I've got no idea what... I don't even know if traditional would be the right word to use in this context, but like traditional Mongolian filmmaking would look like. But the cinematography was great. The lighting was excellent. If she only shot film for a month, she must have shot a huge amount of stuff because the editing is very, very good. There's lots of different shots from different angles, and it's very well composed in terms of the editing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether that's universal or Western, because her and her fellow film creator sound like they live in Germany and have done for a long time and have studied film in Germany, so I don't know if they've taken their like filmmaking style back to where she came from, but I just thought the whole way it was put together was really good. So
any other thoughts?
Well, I know you normally at this point do a diversity data.
Yes, well, I mean, everybody in it was Mongolian.
So not very diverse then.
No.
True. But a good range of male and female parts. But in terms of the Bechdel test, women don't talk to each other a great deal.
No, that's true.
But when they do talk, they are talking about the mother. They're talking about that there are no male camels in this film. Oh well, actually, do we know if the colt may be male?
The colt's male.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right.
I know, if two women talk about a man and he's a camel, does that pass the Bechdel test? We will write to Alison Bechdel and ask.
There isn't a huge amount of interaction and dialogue at all.
Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah. So.
Okay, that just about wraps things up for this month's discussion. So it's time for the ratings. Dave and Annie use a standard 5-star rating system with half stars allowed, which technically is a 10-star system.
Good point. You can't come again. Although that is a good point.
So, Dave, what's your rating for the story of the Weeping Camel?
So, as often happens during the production of the show, my rating for something will go up the more we talk about it, because I'm like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Ooh,
occasionally down.
I mean, very occasionally down, but much more commonly up. 3.5, I think. It is not the kind of thing that I would normally watch. I did, and this is very much a reflection on me and not the film, I did struggle with the long periods of absolute silence because my patience is not.
You do like to fill a silence.
I do like to fill a silence, it's definitely true.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting. It was obviously showing a very different culture that I knew very little about. Yeah, and I enjoyed it.
And what about you, Annie?
Yeah, again, I think I didn't pre-prepare what I was going to rate it. But now my feelings towards it are definitely a 4, I would say. I particularly enjoyed the combination of really fascinating detail about a lifestyle that I know nothing about, and also the bits that I really strongly related to, because people are people wherever they are. So yeah, I think I'm going to go 4. What about you guys?
For me, I'm going to give it a solid 4.5, since you admit it. I think it's a beautiful film. I loved watching it again 20 years later. I think it absolutely stands up. I remember the first time watching it just feeling, I felt better for having watched it. I feel enriched for having seen this film, and that's true 20 years later.
How about you, Terry?
For me, 5 stars.
When I
never rewatch things. Whether it's been sort of 20 years or anything, I very rarely rewatch or reread things because I like to retain the memory of what I thought at the time. And I was really worried going in that I'd sit down and go, oh God, we've recommended something that's really duff. Or, oh, look, you can see the wires controlling the camels or something like that. And when I was watching it, at the end of any film, I often think, would I change anything about that? So there are some films you watch and go, oh, if only they'd made the exposition a bit shorter, or if only they'd done some more here, or that action sequences in a different way. And I finished watching that, still absolutely blown away. And I was thinking, you know, if I could change anything about that movie, I would just make more people have seen it.
Yeah.
So there isn't a single bit of it that made me want to go, I want to change that. And yeah, I'm not overly emotional when it comes to watching movies, but still, you know, the sight of that, of the camel crying and them coming back together, I found it more emotive than I, you know what to do with. So yeah, I do still love it tomorrow.
Oh, I'm glad you've preempted my question. I think the answer was clear that you both still loved it. I'm glad we prompted you to watch it again.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dave, what's your choice for next month?
So I like often in this show to pick something as far as possible away from the thing that we watched.
That's not going to be that hard.
So having watched modern day docudrama, I'm going for futuristic animated.
Oh.
I'm going to pick the Japanese anime film Akira.
Oh, I've been waiting for you to do this to me. For 6 years, I've been expecting it, and it's finally here. Okay.
It is, just to preempt very slightly, it is an interesting example of taking, I can't remember how many manga novels there are. I think it's like nearly 100 or something, and then turning it into a 90-minute film.
So either of you seen it?
No, but we are going to Japan soon, so perhaps we should watch it as well.
Ah, okay. Fair enough.
Cool. Okay, so that wraps it up for this month's episode of We'll Still Love It Tomorrow. Many thanks, as always, to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you to Terry and Liz for joining us for our discussion this month. And of course, thank you everybody out there for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time you shared some media you love and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
So in the meantime, please join us next month to find out what Annie thinks of Akira.
And whether or not Dave still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Don't know why I waved at the podcast mic, but there we go.